This is Only a Game. I'm Callum Borchers. On July 12, 1979, 48,000 fans packed Chicago's Comiskey Park for Disco Demolition Night.
Records flew like frisbees, more fireworks exploded, bottles were thrown, and an estimated 7,000 spectators staged their very own demolition.
Spectators took the field and went out of control.
They got really, I would say, violent. It was so primal and tribal.
That's Darlene Jackson. She was 10 years old when the White Sox held Disco Demolition Night. She was jolted as she watched the postgame news reports.
I remember sitting in our living room. We had green carpeting. And sitting on the floor and my dad in the background saying, "These people have lost their minds."
In recent years, some have said Disco Demolition Night had a dark side, a side many didn't see or didn't want to see 40 years ago. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
In the late 70s, the Chicago White Sox were owned by Bill Veeck. Veeck was famous for his creative promotions, including a pyrotechnic scoreboard and the shower near Comiskey's center field bleachers. But in 1979, neither fireworks nor personal hygiene drew hordes of fans.
We were not doing well.
That's Bill's son, Mike Veeck. In 1979, Mike was the White Sox assistant business manager and promotion director. At the season midpoint, the White Sox were 35-45. The team was drawing fewer than 10,000 fans per game. The poor attendance called for more creatively extreme measures. While the Sox struggled, disco was at the peak of its popularity. It was everywhere, in movies, nightclubs, clothing shops, and on the radio. The genre had grown far beyond its more obscure beginnings in the mid-70s as a dance club phenomenon, especially popular with African Americans, Latinos, and the gay community. But in 1979, there was a growing backlash against disco, particularly at one Chicago radio station.
I caught wind of a guy named Steve Dahl blowing up disco records.
Steve Dahl had lost his job spinning rock records when the radio station he worked for changed to an all-disco format. He quickly found another job at another rock station, but he was still angry.
And every morning I would play a disco record. I'd run the needle across the record, and then I would have an explosion, like blowing up the record.
Just to be clear, Dahl's talking about explosion sound effects. The real explosions would come later. Dahl started holding death to disco rallies at nightclubs. He even hit the airwaves with his own 45 single, a parody of Rod Stewart's disco mega hit, "Do You Think I'm Sexy?"
Do you think I'm disco? 'Cause I spent so much time blow drying out my hair.
Rod Stewart, The Stones, a lot of mainstream rock and roll acts were putting out disco records. I think that there was a feeling of disenfranchisement by the kids wearing the blue jeans and the rock and roll t-shirts.
Dahl's appeal to his growing fan base was too much for Veeck to resist.
Steve was doing a 6 to 10 shift, and at 10:05, I'm standing at the door of the studio going, "Let me in! I got an idea."
Veeck presented his idea for a disco demolition night at Comiskey Park. It would take place between games of a twi-night doubleheader against the Tigers on July 12th. Admission would be just 98 cents for customers who brought in a disco record. Dahl agreed to give it a spin. Veeck had no idea what the promotion would turn into. Early in the morning of July 12th, Mike Veeck met with a group of off-duty Chicago police who would be working security.
And I told them in the morning meeting what we thought the estimated attendance would be. I told them we were going to have 35,000 people. They thought that was hilarious.
But by 4 o'clock that afternoon, about that many had lined up outside Comiskey. Andrew Brown was one of them. He was there on an outing with his Cub Scout den.
I was 10 and a massive baseball fan. This is my first doubleheader. This was a big deal.
Andrew and his fellow Cub Scouts entered Comiskey Park. He says he paid little mind to banners hanging from the upper deck that read, "Disco Sucks." He was too excited about the baseball and the hot dogs he'd soon be eating in the outfield picnic area. It was a 10-year-old's dream. But when he made his way to his seat along the first base side, Andrew noticed that something was very different.
The place was really crowded. I mean, really crowded. There were no empty seats.
And clearly a lot of people who were not there for the baseball.
That's Andrew's older brother, David. He was there too.
A lot of young guys in concert t-shirts.
Hello again, everybody. Harry Carey and Jimmy Pearsall from Comiskey Park, where we're going to have a wild night tonight, a twi-night doubleheader. And the theme song seems to be Disco Sucks. That's
when the game actually started, I was working the seats.
That's Dave Gaborik. He was a teenager selling soda pop that night. As the first game began, he noticed that not all of the paying customers had left their disco records in boxes at the gates, as they were supposed to do.
They were just throwing records periodically on the field. The kids were whipping them out of the upper deck. So it was starting to become a little mayhemish.
But Dave Gaborik and everyone else in attendance hadn't seen anything yet. In the bottom of the ninth of the first game, chants of Disco Sucks almost drowned out the sounds of baseball.
The aisle still jammed. Apparently, fans have can't locate seats. Two pitch. He struck him out and the ball game is over.
The White Sox lost the first game. And as the teams prepared for the second, DJ Steve Dahl took the field in a military Jeep. He wore a helmet and army fatigues.
And when Steve rode in on his Jeep, the electricity picked up several volts. We went from 120 immediately to 220.
The Jeep stopped in center field. Dahl grabbed a microphone and whipped the crowd of about 48,000 into a frenzy.
Since I didn't think anybody was going to be there, I had no prepared remarks, so I just yelled stuff.
Disco sucks! Disco sucks!
The Vex motto had always been, fun is good. But Dahl's tone was not fun.
Disco sucks! And we're never going to let them forget it! They're not going to shove it down our throats! We rock and rollers will resist, and we will triumph!
From there, Dahl directed attention to a large box in center field. It was full of some of the disco records that had been collected at the gates. Then someone lit a fuse.
And records went everywhere, and parts of the box caught on fire.
It was a hot night, and the wind wasn't really blowing. And so, like this, it was almost smog or smoke just settled on the field and gave it sort of this surreal aspect to it.
When the smoke cleared a bit, the damage became evident.
I do remember it taking out a good portion of center field. I mean, there was a huge crater after this was done.
Dahl hopped into the Jeep.
We kind of went around the stadium once on the warning track, and people were throwing cherry bombs and beer at us, and those were the people that liked us. Went out through the center field gate.
And at that point, hell broke loose, and people were on the field racing around, disco records flying.
I remember looking over to my right and seeing guys slide down the foul pole from the upper deck, and that's where I was kind of like, whoa.
Again, former White Sox promotion director Mike Vec.
People jumping from the center field bleachers, which is a 40-foot drop at Old Comiskey. It was safe to say that I had probably mistaken what was going to happen next.
As Dahl made his way back to the press box, he had no idea what was going on. But Dave Gaborik saw the whole thing.
This kid, maybe 19 or 20, with real long hair down to his back, he ran across the outfield, and he slid into second base, and he picked up the bag, and he started waving around. And then that caused an avalanche of all the kids just running on the field and burning banners.
An estimated 7,000 people took the field.
Yeah, I think Mike Vec will tell you that they were underestimated in terms of security.
That's another of Chicago's many Daves. Dave Hoekstra, author of Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. He watched as team officials took the field. One of them was Sox owner Bill Vec, who used a wooden leg as the result of a war injury.
And poor Bill Vec's walking around the field trying to get all these kids to calm down. He's walking around in his peg leg, and his peg leg gets stuck in a piece of sod, you know, and he can't move his peg leg out of the sod. But they just couldn't control the crowd. It got too many people on the field to control.
Some pulled up turf in center field and fanned the flames that were already consuming small piles of disco vinyl. With the chaos raging all around them, the umpiring crew and team officials discussed whether the field had been rendered unplayable.
I distinctly remember Sparky Anderson, who was the manager of the Tigers, coming out to talk to the umpires. I couldn't read his lips, but basically saying, how in the heck are we going to get the second game underway or even played?
Then they got the riot police out there. And then the Mountie police came in on horses.
The Chicago police rolled in, and nobody's going to stand in their way. So they got the field cleared.
But the White Sox had to forfeit the second game. It was just the fourth forfeiture in modern MLB history.
The White Sox promotion obviously backfired when the fans, the young ones, took the demonstration much too seriously, spilled out of their seats, mobbing the field, as you can see. The game.
Bill Veeck sold the team in 1981, and Mike was out of baseball for 10 years. He says Disco Demolition Night played a part in that. But that's not where the story ends, because more people are now questioning the ideological underpinnings of Disco Demolition Night. Mike Veeck calls this revisionist history.
That angers me. It had simply to do with choosing between rock and roll and disco and dance clubs.
It was a little bit deeper than we're just having a good time.
That's Darlene Jackson again. She's also known as DJ Lady D, a well-known house music DJ in Chicago. She was 10 years old on Disco Demolition Night. Her favorite music then was disco, and when she saw the news reports featuring images of Steve Dahl in a military outfit, disco sucks banners, white rioters, and smoldering piles of vinyl, she heard a message.
I think part of what Steve tapped into was a little bit of this unspoken transcript that this is the music of Black people, of gay people, of Latino people, and we should not accept it. We should not try to be a part of it. And so that's why people perceive it as a homophobic and a racist event. The unspoken transcript, a lot of us heard it.
I understand now that there was an underground gay disco scene and all, but we were unaware of all of that.
That's Steve Dahl again.
You know, we were unaware of the origins of it. We basically joined the timeline at Saturday Night Fever and Studio 54, and that was 40 years ago. Things were just different. I don't believe I'm a racist, and I'm not a homophobe. And, you know, it's fairly Kafkaesque in that I don't exactly know how to explain my way out of something that I didn't think in the first place, you know?
Jackson says one simple gesture would go a long way, an apology.
I think that that would be a step in the right direction. I think people would respect that.
But instead of apologizing, the White Sox last month celebrated Disco Demolition Night's 40th anniversary. There were commemorative T-shirts, and Steve Dahl threw out the first pitch. But he says he's now aware of why some feel Disco Demolition Night was an affront.
I understand it, and I'm sorry if that's caused you harm or has hurt you in some way. That's about all I can do.
Dahl has trademarked the phrase Disco Demolition. So what if someone asked him to do another Disco Demolition Night today?
You know, I would say, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a good idea. Because, I mean, based on all the knowledge that I have now of how it affects people and upsets people and whatnot, it doesn't seem cool, I guess.
Disco is an awesome music. It espouses love and it has a lot of energy. And why would anybody hate it?
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Dave Hoekstra's book is Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. Most basketball fans regard Michael Jordan as the greatest of all time, but one very young fan has a different GOAT in mind. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal, dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce, dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
What do all of these people have in common? Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders.
They're all running for president.
And they've all sat down with us on the NPR Politics podcast.
NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
We are going out on the trail with as many of the Democratic presidential candidates as we can and are bringing you in-depth interviews with them.
Come along by subscribing to the NPR Politics podcast.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's time for three stories you should know. That sound from Wednesday's ticker tape parade in New York for the World Cup champion U.S. Women's National Team. And that's where we'll begin this week. I'm joined by New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach via Skype and by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello, sir. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
Well, Charlotte, I have to say that you included a really beautiful personal reflection in your report on the parade for Sports Illustrated. You wrote that seeing these young girls whoop and yell brought back memories of your own childhood experience, watching Brandi Chastain and the U.S. women win a World Cup 20 years ago. So what made the parade so meaningful?
When the U.S. women won in 1999, I was 10 years old. I was watching with my youth soccer team, and I remember absolutely everything about that day. I remember where I was sitting on the couch. I remember ending up on the back of the couch when they won. We were all crying. We immediately all went outside and played a pickup soccer game. And I remember just running faster than I had ever run before and feeling this sense of possibility. It was such a powerful experience for me that after this incredible World Cup win and this incredibly bold and exciting team, the parade, I was just completely overcome. And by the time the last float, I think, with players on it, it was Crystal Dunn and Tobin Heath, they were leading a chant of equal pay, you know, a reference to this lawsuit that the U.S. women's team is bringing against U.S. soccer. And the entire crowd, you know, men, women, children, are just chanting equal pay. And it felt like this huge, incredibly patriotic moment in a hopeful way that I haven't felt in a long time.
We've seen championship teams and we've seen excitement. We have not necessarily seen this. I've wrote about this in New York Magazine. And one of the things that was really inspiring about this, traditionally speaking, activism in sports has been punished. What was so exciting about this, in addition to everything that Charlotte talked about, is the idea that, like, activism is cool. Like, activism is like one of the things that's made this team so fun, right? Their strength and their kind of fight in this has been wrapped up in the enjoyment of it really from the beginning. And of course, that was going on 4 years ago when they won then. But obviously, there's an obvious antagonist, I suppose, in this situation that I think elevates it considerably. So it was exciting for me to imagine what it's going to be like in 20 years, the people that this inspires and what we see from them in 20 years.
You know, one of the standout things for me was that the players weren't even done after the parade. It was kind of like when they were up 3-0 at halftime against Thailand and then piled on 10 more goals after that. You know, they flew from the celebration in New York to the ESPYs in Los Angeles, where they won the Best Team Award. And Alex Morgan said something important on stage. She said, "We obviously enjoy the success on the biggest stage right now, but when the World Cup is behind us, it's the professional league that we need to continually lift up and grow." So, Charlotte, can the World Cup momentum carry over to the National Women's Soccer League?
Yeah, I mean, I really hope so. I did a feature on Julie Ertz. She plays for the Chicago Red Stars. It was around the time that NBC picked up more of their games to broadcast. And she said she was so spot on about it. She was like, you know, girls can now watch this. Like, you can turn on the television and watch this team in your home city. And I'm really hopeful that this momentum carries. I mean, I've been using Instagram solely to watch their Instagram stories because in addition to being incredible on the field and in their activism, they're also just really fun and funny and completely who they are. And I hope that some of that star power can carry them through and make people watch, you know, in the pro league.
The NWSL has a new TV deal with ESPN, by the way, and it starts this weekend with a match between Portland and Orlando. All right, I mentioned the ESPYs a moment ago, and ESPN's annual awards show can be a bit gimmicky. I mean, there's a trophy for best viral sports moment, for example. But the Arthur Ashe Courage Award has become a genuinely big deal, often recognizing civil rights activists. Honorees have included contemporary figures like Caitlyn Jenner and Michael Sam, and people who made a mark decades ago, like Tommy Smith and John Carlos, known for their Black Power salute at the 1968 Olympics. This year's winner is in the decades ago group for sure, basketball legend Bill Russell, who marched the Boston Celtics to 11 championships and also marched on Washington in 1963, standing near Martin Luther King Jr. for his I Have a Dream speech.
Being a high-profile athlete, there was a forum there for me if I choose to use it. And I choose to use it.
That's Russell in a video that ESPN produced for the awards show. He's 85 now and didn't give live remarks, but he got a huge ovation, Will Leach, and you could tell that many of today's athletes clearly see him as a civil rights icon.
Yeah, and as well they should. You know, this is speaking about that New York Magazine column I wrote. Russell was right there back in the famous Ali Summit in 1967, where it was Bill Russell and Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Muhammad Ali all kind of talking about activism in sports back then. And it wasn't just a stance for them to take. They had, like, legitimate consequences. Like, there were immediate problems. And it is so hard to be a professional athlete, to be able to do that and still be able to stand for what you believe in. It's really amazing now, let alone what it was 50 years ago.
And Charlotte, I was really struck by the A-list non-athletes who participated in honoring Bill Russell this week. ESPN's video tribute featured former President Barack Obama, Samuel L. Jackson, Angela Bassett. I mean, Russell transcends sports, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people transcend sports. You know, I think that there's this sort of trope that athletes must be athletes and, you know, they're not rewarded for activism and maybe we're seeing a shift there. And I think we definitely are seeing a shift. I think it's still a real battle for some people to be seen as, you know, like there's an NFL player I know who loves photography and travels all around Europe in the offseason taking these gorgeous film photos, but he's seen as a football player. And having these multifaceted areas, activism is where people see that most because you have to be vocal about it. And I think that while, you know, Will mentioned earlier the idea that part of the appeal of the U.S. women's team was their activism, I think, you know, I saw in the replies to the story I wrote sort of lauding them for it that there are a lot of people who still really don't like that. And so the bravery it takes for, you know, that it took for Bill Russell to do this, even when, like, now it's tough, but back then it was close to impossible. And so the bravery of doing what he did is just staggering.
Well, you know, one thing I'm wondering is how provocative ESPN is going to choose to be with this Arthur Ashe Award down the line. I mean, the Bill Russell tribute video showed him sitting in a theater watching old footage of his activism. But there's also this brief moment when Colin Kaepernick appears on screen. And I will say that ESPN has made some bold selections with the award. Some fans certainly weren't happy about Tommy Smith and John Carlos, for example, who also demonstrated during the national anthem. But the network hasn't picked Kaepernick for the award. And as Charlotte well knows, he won a similar award from Sports Illustrated just a couple of years ago. So I'm curious whether we're going to see Kaepernick on the ESPY stage someday, given that ESPN has that Monday Night Football TV deal with the NFL. All right, Will, close us out.
The MLB All-Star Game was this week, and generally speaking, baseball is always trying to, like, find new ways to bring new fans in because the game is very long, and some would argue slow, some would argue slower. And one of the things that they did at this All-Star Game this year was they mic'd up a lot of the players. They could hear Joe Buck talking. They were able to basically have conversations. One of the things that was really kind of amazing about this was Freddie Freeman was batting. and he was literally had Joe Buck in his ear while trying to hit a Justin Verlander fastball, which is a truly kind of amazing thing. I now am kind of hearing Joe Buck in my ear at my job every single time I do anything now. Will, are you sure you want to use that particular sentence construction? Is that really the adjective you want to go with there?
Yeah, the Joe Buck shoulder angel. Can we listen to that a little bit? We actually have some of this exchange.
Yeah. Watching all this, Freddie, how we doing?
We're doing good. He's throwing really hard over here, guys.
And up.
Yeah, and everything's up. And
I just love the candor there, Will. He's like, this is pretty hard. It's 97 miles an hour.
Yeah, and it's a lot harder with Joe Buck in your ear, I am certain. And I like the idea. I'm glad baseball's a sport that this works particularly well for, because there's a lot of time for thinking, a lot of time to relax. There's times in the outfield where you're not actually doing anything. I am curious to see what would happen. Let's try this in hockey. It feels like something very bad would happen. Baseball may be the right sport for this. I think it's good. I think it's good that baseball's doing it, and it certainly added a new dimension to the televised version of the game that I found pretty enjoyable.
Yeah, maybe for golf too, Will. I'd love to hear some of the golfers chit-chatting on the course. Charlotte, who's an athlete that you'd want to hear mic'd up for a game?
Oh, man. I mean, if the women's team had been mic'd up, I think that would have been, you know, I'm kind of obsessed with them right now, namely from watching Ashlyn Harris's Instagram stories. But I think that it would be really cool to get Nick Kyrgios in tennis and just hear him, like, go off, because I'm sure he says some, like, very juicy things out there on the court.
I'm certain that you're right, but I like the soccer idea too. I mean, who wouldn't have wanted to hear the team's reaction to the teacup celebration, for example,
or oh so my many, God.
Right? It would have been solid gold. Listen, I agree that miking up these players is genius, and it was absolutely the best part of the All-Star game. But, Will, I also had this nightmarish vision during the All-Star game when the Mets' Pete Alonso made what appeared to be a great play at first base and then admitted on the microphone, I don't know if I was on the bag.
How about that play, Pete? I don't know if I was on the bag on that one, though.
We've heard it right from the horse's mouth.
So Will, your instant replay is already a controversial part of sports. What happens when a mic'd up player admits that he got away with something the officials missed?
That's all we need is the challenge flag for mics. That's a very terrifying kind of notion. But listen, the nice thing about the All-Star game, and I think the reason the mics were kind of fun in that regard, was it doesn't count and nobody really cares. I'm going to guarantee you, if that's a big game and Pete Alonso is mic'd up, his foot was on the base, and he will take no evidence to the contrary. Like, that's why I wonder if you can really do this kind of mic'd up player in a game that counts, because A, you'd hear nothing but cursing, and B, the level of competition would make it to where they would find talking to Joe Buck a little less charming than they might find it during an actual All-Star game.
Or even if the All-Star game still counted for home field advantage in the World Series, the stakes might have been too high. So there's one more good reason that we've ditched that formula.
It still cracks me up that was ever a thing we did, to be honest.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
It's like one of the most beautiful baseball weirdness that they actually made the All-Star game count for anything.
Well, I think we've finally gotten right. It's a true exhibition, and now we can hear the players chatting on the field. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and New York Magazine contributing editor Will Leach. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
A newspaper editor once advised me that a well-explained story should be understandable for even an eighth grader. Well, Only Games Matthew Stock did better than that with a piece about basketball shoes that resonated with a five-year-old. And Matthew is here now to share his conversation with one of our youngest listeners. Hey there, Matthew.
Hey, Cal.
So give us the background here. I mean, journalists love to hear from the people who read and listen to our work. It's not every day, though, that we hear from somebody who's kindergarten age.
That's right. So I did a story in the fall about how no WNBA player currently in the league has a signature shoe of her own, and how there used to be signature shoes for women, but there just aren't anymore. So this story came out, and a few months later, I got an email from a woman named Brianne Grace. She's an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina. She's a big fan of Only a Game, and so is her five-year-old son. So naturally, we had to talk. Here's Brianne.
Yeah, my son's name is Silas, and he's sitting right here. You want to say hi, Si?
Hi.
Hi, Silas. How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for talking on the phone with me.
Welcome.
So where does this whole story with you and Only a Game start?
So I listen to Only a Game usually on weekends as I run errands. And I think it must have been after Thanksgiving. Silas and I were coming back from the grocery store. And it happened to be the episode with Simone Augustus, where she talks about getting her first pair of Jordans from her father.
We went to Lady Foot Locker, and my dad just basically walked in and was like, "What's your best basketball shoe?" And a young lady pointed us into the direction of the Jordan. She was like, "Everybody's coming in buying these, so I have to assume that these are the best."
And Si was sitting in the back seat of the car, and he said, "Hey, Mom, what are Jordans?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, Jordans are a pair of shoes. They're really popular when I was a little kid, and they're still popular today." And I said, "Jordans are named after Michael Jordan." And he asked me, "Well, Mom, who is Michael Jordan?" And I said, oh, Michael Jordan. Well, sometimes people say that, you know, he's the greatest basketball player ever.
I was joking. I knew he was.
Oh, you did? I didn't know that. And then what did you say back? Who else did you think is the greatest basketball player ever?
Asia.
Asia who?
Wilson.
Asia Wilson.
Wilson gets around the Corey. Here comes Asia.
And why do you think Asia Wilson is the best basketball
because
player?
Because when I was four or three, she came to read to my old school.
That's right, because you went to the preschool at the University of South Carolina. And so the women's basketball team came and read to your class. They were your class readers, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But she read in the library to us.
She read in the library to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when I said, oh, yeah, some people say Michael Jordan is the best basketball player ever, Silas said, oh, you mean just like Asia Wilson? And, you know, as somebody who grew up playing sports in their childhood, but I didn't have a lot of women athletes to look up to at that time. And so to hear my son talk about, you know, a woman athlete as the greatest athlete of all time was pretty cool. You know, Asia is a real kind of persona here. She does a lot of important philanthropic work here. And so I thought it was pretty cool that he looked up and admired Asia in a way that, you know, I didn't have a lot of women athletes that I could look up to when I was little.
Hey, Silas, can you hear me still?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to basketball games and watch Asia play?
Yeah.
What was so great about her when you watched her?
That she worked with her team.
And what did that make you feel when you watched her do that?
Happy.
And do you know what Asia does now?
No.
I think you do.
Play for the professionals?
Yeah, she plays in professional basketball. She plays in Las Vegas for the Aces.
Asia, quick stepping around Stevens.
Incredible jab step. She talked about it. She observes. She takes her time. But once she
if there were a pair of Asia Wilson shoes, what would you ask your mommy?
To buy them.
That's University of South Carolina professor Breanne Grace and her 5-year-old son Silas speaking with Only a Game's Matthew Stock. Bonnie Erickson designed the famous Philly Fanatic mascot, but her creation for the New York Yankees wasn't quite as successful.
Oh boy. Dandy. He was pretty much relegated to the upper seats in the stadium.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR. We do long-form interviews with journalists breaking the big news stories and with the authors, filmmakers, and musicians behind the best in pop culture. So listen and subscribe.
I'm Callum Borchers. Next week on Only a Game, Muammar Gaddafi. Dictator, sponsor of international terrorism, hockey supporter. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Cal.
So NBA Finals MVP Kawhi Leonard has left the Toronto Raptors to join the Los Angeles Clippers. That part's not surprising. I mean, we knew that leaving Toronto was a possibility. What's more surprising is that he signed only a 3-year deal with the Clips, with the ability to opt out after just 2 years. What's going on, Charlie?
Well, he's trying to think one step ahead, and he's in a position to do that. I think it's interesting that the Clippers were willing to go for that deal.
But don't players like to lock themselves up long-term in case they get injured? They want that guaranteed money, no?
Kawhi has had injury problems, so, I mean, I'm sure, you know, he thought things through, and maybe he figures 3 years is the absolute top any human being can handle being a Clipper. I don't know.
So he's bringing his buddy Paul George with him, and assuming he stays healthy, I mean, do the two of them make the Clippers the favorites to win it all next season?
Maybe not to win it all, but it certainly fattens up the West even more.
So Leonard's deal gives him a chance to possibly become a free agent again at the same time as Paul George, LeBron James, and even the new league MVP, Giannis Antetokounmpo. How'd I do on the pronunciation there, Charlie?
You did very, very well.
Right.
Congratulations.
Greek freak or just Giannis when in doubt. But that brings me to my next question, which is about NBA stars collaborating in free agency. League owners aren't crazy about this, and the NBA's commissioner, Adam Silver, suggested this week that the league needs enforceable rules. Do you like the sound of that?
Well, I think all rules should be enforceable. Otherwise, what's the point of having rules? But if they try to enforce this, they're going to wind up in court and they're probably going to lose. This is going to be a very hard loophole to close.
Just when we thought the NBA's offseason had settled down, we get the Oklahoma City Thunder trading Russell Westbrook to the Houston Rockets for Chris Paul, two protected first-round draft picks, and the right to swap two more first-round picks. Which team and which player comes out on top in that deal?
Oh, I think Westbrook does, for sure. You know, Oklahoma City 2 years ago was the challenger to the Warriors, and now they've almost completely revamped their roster and it's almost completely fallen apart. I think it's the karmic revenge for having screwed Seattle the way the franchise did myself. But now we're going to see the viability of putting a franchise in Oklahoma City because they're going to have to rebuild.
The Chicago White Sox this month will become the first Major League Baseball team to install protective netting all the way to the foul poles. The idea, of course, is to protect fans from balls and sometimes even bats flying into the stands. But some spectators already complain that existing nets obstruct their views. Are bigger nets going to be the norm soon, Charlie?
Oh, absolutely. There's real motivation in the possibility of getting sued for half your franchise. And people will adjust. You know, they adjust to everything. They adjust to ticket prices. They adjust to, you know, changing in uniforms. They adjust to players trading. They'll go to a season's worth of games with all the full netting and everything will be fine.
The Baseball Hall of Fame acquired a new artifact this week. The ball thrown on the first pitch in a professional game to be called ball or strike by a computer. This was a test in the Atlantic League All-Star Game. The idea is to enforce a more consistent strike zone, and MLB is apparently watching this. Charlie, do you welcome baseball's robotic umpiring overlords?
I do. I welcome our new robotic overlords. I do want to see, though, if the robot umpires are programmed to do the chest bump and how the robotic umpires will react to having dirt kicked on their shoes.
Major League Baseball is also watching what happens as the Atlantic League experiments with a new rule allowing players to steal first base. How does that one strike you?
No. Stop this immediately. This is one of those things where you wonder if Rob Manfred really likes baseball or not, even though he's the commissioner of Major League Baseball. The whole thing is freaky. You can steal first base on any pitch on any count not caught in flight will be considered a live ball, and the batter may run to first base, similar to a drop third strike. Nobody is calling for this.
I don't know. I kind of would have liked to see it back when Ichiro was still playing, though. He was so fast, I feel like he would have racked him up.
Yeah, but still, no. This is too freaky even for me. And my tastes in baseball are very odd.
Jim Boughton died on Wednesday. The former big league pitcher and author who lifted the veil on what goes on in major league locker rooms was 80 years old. How will you remember Boughton?
I'll remember him because he transformed everything I believed about sports writing and everything I believed about the people who play the games. That was a groundbreaking book. There's an entire one or two generations of sports fans that would not be the same without Ball 4. It was as transformational in sports as the selling of the president was in presidential politics. And the other thing is, it's funny as hell to this day.
And finally, Charlie, races involving people in costumes are usually sideshows, like the sausage race in Milwaukee or the president's race in D.C., but a horse track in Auburn, Washington, has made a costume race the main event. Emerald Downs held its third annual T-Rex race this month. The video is an internet sensation. Next stop, Olympics?
Oh, I hope so, because you know what it looks like? If you remember Chariots of Fire, where all the runners had their heads thrown back and their heads were bobbing and their tongues were, you know, wriggling out of their mouths and stuff. That's what the end of the T-Rex race looked like.
Well, it's true because, as it turns out, an open T-Rex mouth is not very aerodynamic. You know, it really seemed to fly in the wind and slow people down.
No, and there also were a few people who haven't quite mastered the technique of running in a T-Rex costume yet either.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Bonnie Erickson's name may not ring a bell for you, but if you're a fan of the Muppets or Major League Baseball, her creations have surely made you smile. Throughout her career, she's had some pretty big hits. But like anybody else in the world of sports, she's had some flops too. Reporter Noam Osband has the story.
Bonnie Erickson grew up in Minnesota with dreams of working on Broadway. So, after finishing college, she moved to New York City.
I worked in costuming for about 7.5 years, always wanting to be a designer.
But life took her in an unexpected direction.
I got involved with puppetry, really, through Jim Henson. I heard from a friend that he was looking for a costume designer for one of his projects, doing the costumes for Frog Prince.
They call me Sir Robin, the Brave. Sir Robin the Brave? That's kind of a weird name for a frog, isn't it, fella?
It was 1970, and Jim Henson was also working on a new TV show called Sesame Street. As his studio got more work, he needed more staff.
Jim asked if I would stay on and run the shop.
Bonnie ended up running the shop for 7 years, keeping projects on deadline and making sure everyone had the supplies they needed. But also,
I learned how to make puppets during that time.
Bonnie also learned how to develop her puppets as fully formed characters, as personalities with a backstory. You probably know her work. Miss Piggy? Bonnie designed her. And Waldorf and Statler, the two old hecklers in the balcony?
Well, I've seen a lot of versions of Robin Hood, but none to match this one.
How's that?
The others were all good.
Bonnie made them, too. But although she was enjoying great success in Henson's workshop, it wasn't enough.
Jim knew that I had always wanted to have a business of my own. He said, we just won't lose touch. And surprisingly enough, we didn't. He became one of our first clients.
Bonnie and her husband, Wade Harrison, worked out of their apartment in Brooklyn Heights. They made lots of puppets for TV commercials. And in 1978, they got a new kind of assignment. It started when the Philadelphia Phillies approached Jim Henson and asked if he could design a new team mascot.
And Jim said, no, I'm not doing that kind of thing, but Bonnie Erickson is the person you should talk to. So, Jim, thank you. And we started meetings with the Phillies.
What was your relationship to sports?
Well, my relationship to sports was pretty minimal.
The Phillies already had two mascots, a brother and sister pair named Phil and Phyllis.
They were colonial figures that were really not very performable.
The costumes had huge, cumbersome heads, and that made it hard to be active.
And I think I wanted to make a shape that was going to have its own sort of character so that if you put a performer or a human being in it, it was going to be funny just because of the way it moved.
And so Bonnie started creating a brand new team mascot. She got inspiration from the Phillies marketing department.
They had a slogan, which was "Philly, be a Philly fanatic." I took that as wanting to have a megaphone, so that's where the snout for the fanatic came from.
The fanatic was green, large, pear-shaped, and wore a Phillies jersey.
And on the back, we wanted to give him a sort of logo of his own, so we gave him a five-pointed star.
Like she had done at Jim Henson's studio, Bonnie created a whole personality, complete with its own biography.
He evolved in the Galapagos and became this enormous baseball fan because we figured who could contest that. This seemed to be the perfect background for a character that nobody could describe. It's a purely fantasy animal.
Finally, on April 25th, 1978, the fanatic was ready for his debut.
Yes, it was a beautiful day. It was a sunny day. I have no idea whether the team won or not. I hope they did.
For the record, the Phillies beat the Cubs 7-0.
Everybody decided to just let him appear, not to make any big announcement. This was the Phillies fans. You weren't going to force them into anything. And so he just sort of appeared. He came on the field. The costume looked clean, bright, and got a lot of laughs. And that it's the laughs you're waiting for. So all in all, that first day was a big success.
When did you realize the fanatic was going to become huge?
We went into a pop-up store, and I am totally surrounded by Philly Fanatic product.
A lot of these products were Bonnie's own design.
It was enormously satisfying to stand in the middle of all this stuff.
It was also pretty lucrative. Before the Fanatic debuted, Bonnie and Wade had offered to sell the copyright to the Phillies for $1,300. The team turned down the offer.
Once they saw how successful it was and how popular it was, then they chose to buy the copyright from us. Cost them more.
$248,700 more, to be precise. The Fanatic quickly became one of the most popular mascots in sports. In 2011, Forbes magazine called it America's favorite mascot. However, not all of Bonnie and Wade's mascots were such big hits. Not at all.
Oh, boy. Dandy. We were approached by the Yankees, which surprised me because even though I'm not a big sports fan, I knew that they were pretty traditional. I was excited about the fact that the Yankees, our hometown team, was interested in having a mascot. And my thinking at the time was to do something very traditional.
Like the Fanatic, Dandy was large and pear-shaped.
He was a dyed-in-the-wool Yankee, which meant that we did fur fabric that alternated white with blue stripes. And he had a big hat that spun around on the top of his head. He had a handlebar, red handlebar mustache, and looked very much like a turn-of-the-century kind of baseball player.
Dandy's design needed approval from one of the most feared owners in all of sports, George Steinbrenner. Bonnie didn't know much about him.
Wade knew, but he wasn't going to tell me how intimidating George Steinbrenner could be, I think.
Wade and Bonnie headed up to Yankee Stadium to meet the boss.
He seemed to like the sketch, but he said that the blue was not dark enough. And I said, well, if we're doing product, it shouldn't really be that dark because it's not going to be that appealing. So we had, right off the bat, we had an argument going. We did resolve it. We did finally hit on the right color. But I have to say, when I came out of the meeting, the people in George's office who had been sitting in the back part of the room during the conversation said, we don't really think anybody's ever contradicted George.
Dandy was snake-bitten from the get-go. On July 10th, 1979, weeks before Dandy was to debut, the Yankees played an away game in Seattle. The Mariners were about to host the All-Star game, and they'd hired a mascot associated with another team, the San Diego Chicken. The Chicken was just a few years older than the Fanatic, and with its bright, colorful feathers, the mascot had become nationally famous. Kids and fans loved the Chicken. Sadly, Yankees outfielder Lou Piniella did not. While the Chicken was placing a hex on Yankees pitcher Ron Guidry, Piniella chased after the mascot, cursing and ultimately throwing his own glove at it.
George Steinbrenner was also furious, and his comment at that time was, those things don't belong on the field. Well, George, in about 2 weeks, you're going to be introducing your own character. And what does this mean?
It meant Dandy wouldn't receive team support, but no one told that to Bonnie and Wade.
We came to the introduction of the character, and we sat in George's booth, and we never saw the character at all. Not through the entire game, we never saw the character. So that was sort of an indication that this was not going to be something they supported or that they were going to promote.
It got worse. Not long after Dandy's introduction, Yankees captain and beloved icon, Thurman Munson, died in a plane crash.
Since we had introduced the character around the same time, there was a confusion about whether this character was inspired by him.
The problem was Dandy kind of did resemble Munson.
He had that same kind of turn-of-the-century look with the handlebar mustache, and often it's been mistakenly thought that I was trying to do a Thurman Munson character.
Dandy was relegated to the stands and left to fend for himself.
In the upper decks, it could be pretty volatile sometimes, so we were concerned for the safety of the character. So I think they didn't want to provide someone to accompany the performer, which we thought was paramount.
After several years, Dandy's contract expired.
We decided not to renew, and I think they were just as happy not to as well. It was disappointing to find that the character didn't take off the way we had hoped it would. But it was just, you know, it's everybody fails. There's you don't hit it every time.
That story came from reporter Noam Osband. Bonnie Erickson and her husband Wade continued to design some of the most recognizable mascots in sports, including the Montreal Expo's beloved Yuppie, the Kansas City Chiefs' Casey Wolf, and several others. We'll have photos of her with her creations at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Arlo Moore-Bloom is our intern, our technical director is Marquise Neal, our executive producer is Karen Gibbon. I'm Callum Borchers. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.